thank you all for coming. I'm not going to talk to you about Black action heroes today, unfortunately. I'm going to go with something a little bit more stodgy, but hopefully interesting all the same. This essay is the product of sort of a series of interests that I didn't deal with in my dissertation. There were things that kind of popped up and that I ignored because I wasn't really sure how to talk about interior selves and exterior selves. And so the talk kind of gave me the opportunity to try to figure that out, to work through it. So I start actually in a very similar place that I start the dissertation, and then I go someplace entirely unexpected also to me. So we'll just go through it. I start with this quote by Slavoj Žižek, and it's an interesting quote because it's actually from an interview. It's not a scholarly quote, and it's slightly more strongly opinionated than his scholarly work is. "What I despise in America is the studio actor's logic. If there is something good in self-expression, do not be oppressed, open yourself, even if you have to shout and kick the others, everything in order to express and liberate yourself. This stupid idea that behind the mask there is some truth." We'll see if this works. Awesome. All right. "Most of the months, short dry months and long wet months between January of 2001 and October of 2003, I spent in Ljubljana, Slovenia, doing research with artists and curators whose work was, in decidedly backhanded ways, helping to build a post-socialist, post-Yugoslav version of that nation. I had chosen Slovenia to study because there was something odd, or at least unfamiliar, about the ways in which mimicry was being used for self-expression, most especially in the last years of Yugoslavia, 1980 to 91, and the first few of independence, 1991 to 2003. Though my interests were originally quite focused on how this transition was being accomplished both in fact and in imagination, without a rhetoric or even really any observable laudatory practices of difference making, something else began to gnaw at me as the weeks passed into years. There was a quietness, almost a discreetness tied to madness. One simply didn't see crazy behavior emanating from crazy people. In public, at least, they were, if anything, more self-controlled than their sane, more easily functional counterparts, so much so that it took me the better part of years to even be able to see their differences. They were there, but mildly so, and silent. Before having come to Slovenia, and before having learned to see the belabored normalcy of those teetering on sanity's edge, I had operated with a sense of mental illness as a space outside of cultural strictures. It was, as I understood it, a way out. A place of brazenness, of fistfights in libraries, and spittle in the face of oppressors, of conversations with private demons in public places. By this rationale, if a society is tight, as Slovenia is, and behavior within it strictly regimented, as is also the case in Slovenia, it seemed to me only logical that strangeness, sickness, drunkenness, or craziness would be sites or social positions from which one could rebel, rationally or not, against family, friends, and colleagues, bosses and strangers, bus drivers and bank clerks, traffic lights, train schedules, and the requirements of a steady job, of fatherhood, of matching socks. In other words, pretty much everyone and all of it. I had understood craziness and other forms of physically invisible abnormality to be a sort of freedom from the tourniquet of normalcy. Yet never in my near to 3 years in Slovenia did I witness insanity in the form of a conversation held with no one in particular. Occasionally, drunk men alone would make an aggressive move toward me. These, contrary to all my expectations, were never sexual in nature, but rather audaciously corrective, like the drunk man on a darkened street late at night who stopped dead in his tracks, mouth agape, to point his finger in felt anger at my pale pink cherry-stippled knee socks. These were lightning rods of ire throughout my time in country. Really, like, terrible. More common were groups of young men drunk together, lurching jovially through the park late at night, who would move as a mass against random passersby, again, never in any way that raised hackles of fear, or at least not my hearty American hackles, shouting out Merry Christmas in English, or Lepa Chelada, which means nice helmet, in Slovene, accompanied by a feigned move to jam something in my bike spokes as I passed. And this is because I wore a bicycle helmet until I had so many very close to dangerous events happen with other people that I stopped wearing it. I decided it was too dangerous actually to wear it. However, even drunken interactions such as these were few and far between, always taking place out of doors and were in equal measure benevolent and malevolent, even the most shocking of which were aimed more at correcting my aberrant behavior, socks and helmet, than doing any actual harm. In general, drunks, especially the chronically drunk, kept their drunkenness well contained, enjoying themselves heartily without making much of a public stir. This was noticeable to such a degree that the Lonely Planet's inaugural guidebook to Slovenia referred to the local lushes as, quote, the politest drunks in Europe. Drunks, however, are not for the most part mentally ill, and it was the silence of the psychotic and the schizophrenic that I had come to find so puzzling in its absence. My initial supposition was that everyone with serious neuroses or psychoses was either institutionalized or heavily drugged, i.e. not visible because they were not present. Or in local parlance, they were at Polje, a large mental health institution on Ljubljana's edge, where, as rumor had it, certain people, always pointed out with a discreet jab of the index finger in the direction of their receding back, went from time to time. Over time, however, as my months in Slovenia wore into years, I slowly became more aware of aberrant behavior. The too thin of anorexics became distinguishable from the popular aesthetic for men and women both of mild emaciation. I heard stories of cutters and then began to notice them, young women especially, with histories of small slices scarring their arms. The suicide statistics, among the highest in the world for boys and men, and the personal stories behind these took on a new density of importance. And every so often, the way that somebody moved down the street felt out of keeping with the norm, a little too slow or with a distinctive step, something odd about the angle of a head or the hang of the arms. In every case, from that of the anorexic to the man having difficulty buying bananas, the degree of difference was extremely slight and very mild to the eye. It was often difficult, in fact, to pin down what exactly made this difference noticeable at all. That is to say, mental illness, when not explicitly pointed out, was understated, and more particularly from a performative point of view, it was silent. Yet as I failed to see this lack of rebellion, this inward turn of sickness, as indicative of a cultural mode of mental illness, against all evidence to the contrary, I simply continued to wait for the explosion of speech and expletive that so characterized the crazy and the drunk in my own culture. And that is how I came to be sitting in Shent, a daycare facility for the mentally ill, Duševne zdravosti, which means spiritual health, actually, in Slovene, on my last day in Slovenia. I was wedged into the merest of spaces between the dark edge of a desk and the window, and seated across from me a small woman, really quite small, Spela Zgonc, who had 20 minutes to spare. What Miss Zgonc offered me the chill morning, that chill morning, in the quietest and simplest of ways, was a key. As with just a few words, she managed to pull Slovenia into sharp relief and simultaneously make it a place I could hardly imagine, a place so strict in stigma avoidance, so turned inward turned, so focused on self-control and personal responsibility that it was almost inconceivable to me, despite the fact that I had lived there in the midst of it. In a word, Miss Zgonc made it seem the most sensible thing in the world that crazy people in Slovenia don't talk to themselves. To do so would reflect badly on them and upon their families and their friends. Slovenes, she said, looking at me quietly across the cluttered corner of her desk, are self-contained, self-critical, and deeply afraid of stigmatization. We, she said, are judgmental and capable of extreme unkindness towards one another based on the merest infraction of the norm or manifestation of oddity. Then she explained, when an individual begins to lose control of him or herself, there is an inward turning, a hiding of a madness which manifests in most cases first in phobias or paranoia, both of which are mental diseases that keep one indoors and which, by their very nature, limit human contact. Perhaps more important is that these disorders are often understood to be symptomatic of personal failing and of individual weaknesses by those afflicted and by their close friends and family. This was Ms. Scon's second point, that because of an immense lack of education about mental health, deviations from the norm, which in other places might be understood as, for example, a chemical imbalance, like manic depression, or a social disease, like acute anxiety disorder, are in Slovenia thought to be indexes of individual weakness of will. If one goes mad, and the importance of this cannot be overestimated, as Ms. Zgonc in our short interview returned to it time and again, it is read both personally and socially as a singular failing of self-control, for which the individual is deeply responsible. This was true to such a degree that despite all my struggles living there among them with my pink socks and much maligned bike helmet, the simplest explanation for the silence of madmen had never occurred to me, that they too struggle at all costs to maintain the appearance of normalcy, to not attract attention to themselves, and to not publicly manifest their own difference. Madness is not in Slovenia a place of liberation, of a loud, unseemly fuck you flung outward at the rest of society. It is rather an even more extreme manifestation of the self-same management of impression that characterizes the rest of everyone. What happens behind apartment doors, Ms. Zgonc said, most pointedly, is another matter altogether. But when in public, the stigma of difference, regardless of what form that difference takes, is, simply put, anathema. What Ms. Gons casts in terms of closeness, image management, and self-control, Žižek, in the quote with which this essay opened, neatly confirms, though, as is usual, through a sort of inversion. And I have it again. Rather than openly lauding a cultural as much as an individual need for a self that is manifestly under control, he proclaims his distaste for cultures, here glossed as American, that insist upon self-exposure, self-expression, self-liberation, and more generally, just openness. Do not be oppressed, he says, speaking as an as-if American, addressing some imagined army of the introverted. And open yourself, even if you shout and kick the others. And then changing registers, he ceases play acting and begins to critique what he has just voiced. He continues, everything in order to express and liberate yourself, this stupid idea that behind the mask there is some truth. What is interesting here is that Žižek is clearly expressing a personal opinion, much more so than elsewhere in his scholarly work, where he makes similar claims, albeit with far less felt sentiment. In The Sublime Object of Ideology, for example, he writes, the mask is not simply hiding the real state of things. The ideological distortion is written onto its very surface. And in The Puppet and the Dwarf, he again reiterates this idea, saying, quote, the ultimate ideolatry is not the idealizing of the mask, the image, but the belief that there is some hidden positive content behind the mask. This is not, then, an idle thought, nor is it simply an academic claim. Clearly, Žižek feels something strongly about how self-expression works, and more importantly, where it is to be rightly found. One ought not, each of these exemplars enjoins, look for the truth of self on the insides, nor underneath some surface, thought to mask another more true or more authentic state of being. Rather, and quite to the contrary, the essence of things, people, systems, power relations, ideology is right and readable on their surfaces. Sometimes, he says, quote, the only truly subversive thing to do when confronted with a power discourse is to simply take it at its word. The same might be true, one can extrapolate, of individual people. Perhaps rather than searching for the truth of self below surface level expressions, the only subversive, read here, correct, thing is to take these surfaces at their word. It is not my goal here to provide a long and lengthy analysis of Žižek and his oeuvre, but rather to situate him and his work within a distinct cultural context. Žižek is not only an internationally renowned philosopher, he is also a Slovene, and his opinions, his aesthetics, and many of ideas emerge from the family life, street life, and political life of that country during the 1970s and 1980s, as Yugoslav communism began to grow weak in the knees. That is to say, that despite the fact that when, in his theoretical work, Žižek speaks about the truths of human behavior via, in most cases, Lacanian readings of psychosymbolic processes, he presents this work as if it were universally applicable, when in fact it's both grounded in and reflective of a very specific cultural context. This context, while imminent in all of his work, is here in this one quote, this one, from an interview rather than an essay, made palpable. The unusual degree of emotionality allows for an equally unusual twist of expertise. Spelez Gons, it turns out, is more of a cultural theorist than is Slavoj Žižek, and he in turn is more of a native informant, whose biases, no matter the terms in which they are cast, serve primarily to prove her point. This reversal of role is one that I want to keep alive throughout this essay, limiting Žižek's usefulness to the insights he leaks without much knowing it, and granting to those Slovenes who were thinking critically about their home culture, regardless of their actual position in that society, the role of expert and theorist. This is perhaps easier to do in Slovenia than elsewhere because, at least in the years immediately preceding EU integration, a great many people from all walks of life were thinking about what it was to be Slovene, what could be said to constitute Slovene culture, and what, if anything, granted the nation identifiable particularity. This quest for national self-knowledge was, in Slovenia's case, of particular importance during this period because it, that is the nation, too easily slipped from Western minds. And even when it was remembered in a general sort of way, it was often quickly confused in name and occasionally in attribute, like location, language, and historical alliance with someplace else. Slovakia, Romania, Estonia, Segovia. I have for you a little map. Even 2 years into my PhD, my chair of my committee introduced me to somebody as his student who was studying in Romania after I'd been in Slovenia for 2 years. So it really goes quickly. Like it's something that slips away very fast from consciousness. Like there's somehow not something to grab a hold of with your mind in talking about it. And Segovia is my absolute favorite. Like a town in Spain. Like not even a big town in Spain, a little town in Spain. that it holds more weight somehow, and Slovenia does. So official, i.e. state, and scholarly work on the subject of Slovene particularity tends to focus on elements recognizable to anyone familiar with the history and development of European nationalism and the carving out of discrete European nation-states, a distinctive language, a unique literary tradition, a history of high cultural productions, and a clear relationship between the land as both geography and environment and the people who inhabit it. Both Skonce's commentary and Žižek suggest, however, that Sloveneness as a practice category of national particularity may rest in a commonality less likely to be taken up by advocates of national exceptionalism, or at least specificity, than our common language, land, cultural patrimony, and the historical economies of state. In Slovenia, they claim, there is a strong relationship between a cultural emphasis on being normal, with all of the lateral as well as hierarchical sanction that this implies, and on the importance, indeed the substantive materiality of surfaces. Opening oneself is enjoined against, self-expression maligned, while what is given, that is, what is available to the immediacy of the senses, is posited as being the correct place to seek to know someone or something for what it really is. In Slovenia, it would seem that being a person involves closing oneself in, though interestingly enough, without references to interiority per se. What one uses to accomplish this closing, which ought simultaneously be a sort of broadcast of conventionality, becomes the apperceivable substance of self. Apartment doors and apartment walls can be used for this, or phobias and paranoia, or alcohol and other accessible forms of self-medication, or fashion and subcultural affiliation, include here bankers and businessmen as much as punks and rockabillies. And when necessity demands excursion, even the least functional of people work to clothe themselves in appropriate actions of the sort that can be learned rote: politesse, a proper gait, clean pants, cash exchange, and silence. Such imitation of proper behavior is, as Judith Butler has pointed out, and I will also argue here, is not only the provenance of the mentally ill, or of others not marked as such, it is simply that their occasional incomplete mastery of it reveals the attempt. What's more, irregularity and surface-level approximations can be read off of those surfaces, not because such failings necessarily point to hidden interior states of presumed distress and disorder, though this is how Westerners, Americans, and Western Europeans would likely read them, using our own thick lens of bias toward hidden yet secretly determinate inner states. Following, however, a more Slovene logic, one might say that it is possible to know madness or other sorts of irregularity because only the unwell would fail to appear normal in precisely these ways. The drama is played out on the surface of persons in those elements, oral, visual, olfactory, most readily available for self-expression. Likewise, when the drunk would threaten violence in response to a bicycle helmet or voice outrage at a particularly garish pair of socks, the very public form such reactions took indexed drunkenness, theirs, as a state of being made publicly available through apperceivable actions, as much as they were calling attention to and actively sanctioning formal inappropriateness, in this case, my own. But like the quietness of the mentally ill that so closely mimicked the quietness of the well, the scrawniness of the anorexic that was so nearly undifferentiated from the slimness of the rest, the audacity of the drunk to act upon and voice the aspersions cast like arrows from the eyes of the sober, each point to a concerted attention to maintaining surface level indistinguishability from ideal type. It may be this particular ability to appear both as if other and simultaneously as self-identical to that indexed by one's formal approximations that marks Slovenes as culturally, indeed nationally particular. Certainly this has been argued by others, albeit by artists and lay theorists rather than statesmen and scholars. If this is the case, if, that is to say, distinction is, in the Slovene case, linked to a value placed upon formal approximation that is coupled with a functional distaste for rhetorics of secreted essences, would it not then make a certain sense that they slip in their particularities from Western minds? Or to put it another way, if rampant appropriation and a lack of surface-level differentiation was what most consistently marked Slovenes as culturally distinct, then blending in, that is, seeming the same as, rather than sticking out, would be the anticipated and indeed the sought-after result of national as well as individual self-expression. In this brief essay, I will attempt to convince you of the first of these claims, that particularity, whether national or individual, might just as well stem from modes of appropriation as from the pointed expression of a minutia of differences, and to sway you, if not convert you, in the direction of the second, that in Middle Europe there appears to be a people who do not double and then divide themselves into an outer accessible and inner hidden selves. but who instead congeal being into that which is readily available to the senses, who in changing form change themselves, who in playing with selves play with form, and who when asked to perform themselves in ways indexical of an interiority hidden from view become angry and in various subtle ways protest and resist the division. I do not do this simply as an anthropological exercise, the aims of which might be to prove yet again to a crowd of doubters that cultural diversity does in fact exist, even among middle-class European white people who all look and act pretty much alike, which is, of course, in the Slovene case, exactly the point. But rather to point with some force, to illustrate with some force, that changes of economic system and of geopolitical alliance necessitate changes of both self-conception and self-expression. Since Slovenes are the ones integrating into Europe and not the reverse, and if I'm correct in my supposition, since Slovene practices of selfhood are decidedly odd from a generalizable European point of view, about which I will say more below, then they are the ones who must become other to themselves in order to be what it is they so easily and earnestly mimic becoming. In other words, in order for Slovenes to become readable to Europeans as European, there is a register to which they must adapt that goes beyond surface level approximation. They will need insides, invisible yet essential, and the ability to represent them faithfully. One immediately enters fairly sticky ground here. Anthropologists have, at least since 1912 and the publication of Emile Durkheim's Elementary Forms of Religious Life, made claims about the non-existence of invisible things, most especially those invisible things fundamental to a foreign culture's self-understanding. Spirits do not subsist in rough-hewn idols, we say. Stones do not sing. The dead do not come on great ships bearing foodstuff. Witchcraft does not explain unfortunate events. Women are not in their essence polluting. Deities do not ride a woman or a man as these might ride a horse. Crunchy brown foods are not better for the body than our soft white foods. The devil does not cause crops to fail nor minds to collapse. And more recently, quarks do not exist independently of those researching them, and markets do not reflect anything like the inherent value of a good. One might even say that this procedure of swapping the native's mysticality, and by native here I mean anyone sufficiently immersed in a particular culture to believe that the invisible yet causal is real, for an explanatory matrix grounded in social relationship lies at the heart of the anthropological project. It may even be that this process of making what is mystical and invisible into the worldly, the testable, and the independently verifiable is precisely the point at which anthropology can be vaunted as a science. There are reasons for this, of course, the most oft repeated of which is that anthropologists are themselves cultural beings, most of whom even today come from Western Europe or its British colonies, and that they are, as such, deeply steeped in the cultural and religious traditions of the European Enlightenment and Judeo-Christian notions of what beings are and how spirits work. A second and less widely bandied about reason is that without reliable and socially agreed upon practices of divination, which outside of the scientific method Westerners by and large lack, it is in fact very difficult to make truth claims about the causal powers of invisible things, regardless of whether these are inside bodies like souls, selves, or sicknesses, or outside of them in the future, say, or in the past, or at a vast enough distance that they can no longer be seen by eyes, natural or augmented. The self, like a quark, like the evil eye, is just such an invisible thing, untenable, presumed, practiced, but very different for a scientist, social or otherwise, to pin down, except in the durability and consistency of its effects. Much of the same can be said of the soul, when such is even thought to exist, of consciousness, of essence, and even of mind. Lacking proof, one is left with the intricate local systems of practice and interpretation, and this is precisely what anthropologists of the self do. They look to language, to ritual, to truth claim, to interaction, to sanction, to silences and sacrednesses. In other words, the invisible yet causal is brought into the realm of the visible through a careful examination of its conjuring and its effects. So, part one, we've now arrived. Walter Benjamin, Ljubljana, 1986. I can put that on. That's Walter Benjamin there. In June 1986, Tito is 6 years dead, and Yugoslavia is in economic collapse, though it has not yet turned terminal, turned against and eviscerated itself. Indeed, there was little reason to believe in 1986 that the nation might not still be salvaged. Reformers were everywhere, warriors were few, and communism had yet to implode across the rest of Eastern Europe. That collapse was still 3 years in the future, and utterly unimaginable in its scope. In June of 1986 in Ljubljana, Slovenia's capital city, Walter Benjamin stood before a crowd of a modest size and spoke about the so-called later works of Piet Mondrian, the dead Dutch painter of some renown. Of course, Benjamin, too, was dead by 1986, 46 years dead by his own hand in the autumn of 1940, a death that was followed some 4 years later by Mondrian's own collapse from pneumonia in New York City in 1944. The paintings, however, under discussion that Ljubljana Spring Day, were dated between 1963 and 1997. The earliest thus had seen brushed to canvas some 20 years after Mondrian's death, while the last was completed 11 years after the date of the lecture in question. Rather than delivering a treatise focused solely on the artistic merits of the later works, and rather than formulating a plausible set of Benjaminesque musings that could be mistaken for those of the original name bearer, the Slovene Benjamin took a different route. He led his audience into a ridiculous, metaphysical, earthquake-riddled scenario of a museum, at a museum of all places, in order to make a point not about Mondrian, but about the nature of the copy, of which he was, of course, also one. One sunny day. And I'm going to read this whole thing. But you can read it too. Huh? Oh, it disappeared. Oh, that's the great, there we go. Is it still there? Yeah, all right. One sunny day, the false Benjamin said, and I begin quoting here from somewhere in the middle of the lecture, we set off for the National Museum. And he continued, suddenly we have the feeling that we have seen something familiar. We are sure it's a mistake or an error, and at first we reject the idea that we have already seen the painting we are observing. We rub our eyes and look again. Quite definitely Mondrian, and it is the same Mondrian we saw a few decades earlier. Suddenly, we feel the earth begin to shake. We look quickly at the wall. It, too, is shaking. We are struck by a thought, earthquake. But what is happening to our painting? While the other Mondrian, with that other Mondrian painting, it is completely still. It is actually floating in non-existent space, as though what is happening around it does not concern it. Pause. Still shaken by the previous dramatic events, we make ourselves a cup of coffee. Sit on the floor, light a cigarette, and when we think about everything that has happened, our eyes accidentally, almost absentmindedly, flow off the wall, off to the wall where we have placed the painting. In an almost empty and half-lit room, on a wall which was once white, two Mondrians are hung, an original and a copy. We would not be even slightly surprised by their similarity. Formally, there are actually two, the same painting, but we know that only one is the original, painted as a result of Mondrian's interest in the problems of space, plans, this says, the translation says plans, I think it might be planes, but it could be one or the other, verticals, horizontals, primary colors, gray, black, yellow, and red, and all of this can be seen in the painting. We look at the copy. Everything about it is just as in the original. But we can say for sure that the unknown painter of the copy was not concerned with horizontals, verticals, colors, and backgrounds when making the painting. We say that the sole sensible reason for this copy being made was the fact that copying Mondrian is nonsensical. The subject of the artist's interest was in the copy itself and its relation to the original. What we have before us, therefore, are two paintings, which are the same, but with two completely different ideas hidden behind them. We can see in the original what its idea is, but we cannot say the same of the copy. This means that the copy contains an idea of its ideal, as well as its own idea, the idea of a copy. Hence it follows paradoxically, although seemingly truly, that the copy can be multi-layered in its meanings and more complex than the original. Of the many curious things going on in these passages, there are two I would like to pick up on here. First, something decidedly odd has happened to the individual as it is performed by Benjamin, already a copy, who speaks of copies. Despite being singular in form, he is plural in person, indeed doubly so. His appellation marks him as other than himself. Technically, this form of personage is called a multiple single, and it is common in its usage by Slovene artists. Second, his use of language spreads him out into the crowd until, not unlike the king, he narrates with one voice the purported experiences of the plurality. That is, he consistently speaks in the plural, and by this means includes us here now, as much as them there then, in his account. It is not Walter Benjamin, doubly not, as Walter Benjamin is dead, who sets off for the museum. But, we are told, we do it, as if we had been there with him. We see the same Mondrian we saw a few decades earlier. We feel the earth begin to quake and the walls begin to shake, and we see the paintings floating in non-existent space, except that, as we all well know, we were not there. What's more, our not-there-ness is indexed by the form of the lecture itself. Despite the first-person plural narration, had we been there, we might well find ourselves attending a therapy circle or a church event together to discuss it. But it's unlikely that we would be preached to about it in just this faux art historical way. We would remember all of it well enough ourselves. I mean, it's kind of radical, the whole thing. So, nor is the swapping of the singular for the plural the only odd thing that Benjamin has done with his person and with ours in this lecture. He's also making it clear that though he has but one body, this body is shared between all of us. It is his body, in fact, that affords us, all of us, a common experiential nexus. And though it may be singular, we are not. Thus, phrases like, we make ourselves a cup of coffee, prompts the literalists among us to wonder if a single cup will be enough. Likewise with the cigarette. It was, after all, a traumatic event. Our mouth might not be content with a single cigarette. And when our eyes wander and alight absentmindedly upon the painting turned to two, our eyes, as our absent-mindedness, have been claimed for the collective. Even if unintentional, the lexical awkwardness of Benjamin's attempt to adequately meld him and us into a sensible entity lends a certain structural support to his final point on the multi-layeredness of meanings and the inherent complexity of copies. He, a copy himself, is more than the original Benjamin was, and we, made to be part of him, add to the complexity of his person. In acting, in falsifying, in pluralizing, and in multiplying, he facets himself, becoming a more difficult entity without becoming a deeper one. While all of this is quite interesting, it was also in my experience in Slovenia quite common. One was constantly being told how one felt about what one was experiencing, most especially when culture was in question. A more contemporary example, opening at random, and truly, this small book, which I open often at random, the catalog for Vulgata, the third triennial of Slovene contemporary art, an exhibit that occupied the creaking halls of Moderna Galleria, Slovenia's National Museum of Modern Art during the long and dreary winter months of 2001, I found the following short 400-word exegesis on the contemporary video works of Maja Litzel. It begins. I think I have it. Yes. Much shorter. It begins, Maja Litzel's video work, Untitled, 1999, shows the artist on a small monitor facing the camera, talking and gesticulating. A pair of headphones transmit Litzel's voice. One ear pad conveys the speech, whereas the other gives the listener the impression of Litzel talking with the other voice. The other voice makes fun of Litzel's statements, smiles at the pompous tone of her voice. And then from the middle, the deconstruction and alteration of the time structure of the narration based on an antithesis of the narration and a synchronicity distances the viewer from his voyeuristic look. And at the end, here the subjective returns to itself, which lends an oppressive openness to the work. We are forced to realize that anything goes does not necessarily mean that anything is possible. We are trapped in the conditionalities of different worlds. All of the elements are in place. 15 years after the Ljubljana Benjamin, 5 years after Žižek's published complaints to Geert Lovnik on the pushing and kicking of self-expression, and 5 years before my conversation with Spele Gonc about closed doors, Gregor Podnar, Vulgata's head curator, describes a video work in terms of its oppressive openness. A queer phrasing, perhaps, but the sentiment should by now be a familiar one. More relevant to the immediate point, however, is the gentle progression from the beginning of the text through to the end of the force with which one's experience of the artwork, indeed the very substance of oneself, is mandated by one's interactions with the object. In the first paragraph, an ear pad, quote, gives the listener an impression, a notion which is feasible, though of course simultaneously arguable. Were the work here in this room for us to listen to, some listeners might be given the impression implied, and others might be given a different impression altogether. Indeed, some might just find it dull, or for other more personal and unfathomable reasons, decide to take off the ear pad and wander away. This, it should be noted, was not an infrequent reaction of actual visitors to the actual exhibit. Several sentences later, however, the audience's situation has become more dire, for it turns out that the time structure of the narration, quote, distances the viewer from his voyeuristic look. How exactly, one might ask, does an antithesis of the narration and a synchronicity work to split the viewer off from his voyeuristic look? And more fundamentally, how did it come to pass that the viewer is male? Photographic evidence to the contrary. This is not such a great slide, but the picture in the catalog is of a woman watching the video. And at what point did the viewer's stroll through the gallery, participating in the art in a proper sort of way, stopping to look at it, realizing he should put on the headphones, actually putting them on, and listening for a bit to the contradictory speech within, did his look transform from an appropriate mode of interacting with art to a perverse one? What is gained by accusing the viewer of voyeurism, even if it is a voyeurism subverted and diverted by the viewer's interactions with the artwork? All of these, of course, are the wrong questions to be asking. But it is through asking them that a misunderstanding about the nature of this catalog essay, in quotes, irony quotes, as a catalog essay emerges into visibility. It is neither objective nor is it descriptive. It provides very little useful information about the work of art, revealing neither its history nor its inspirations. It says nothing of the artist's intentions, nor the aesthetics of the piece, nor does it elucidate the curators, who is in this case also the authors, reasons for including it in the exhibit. Formally, then, it is a catalog essay. This is the first page of the bit on Maya Lutzel. Formally, then, it is a catalog essay. It's published in a catalog. It is laid out in an artful manner. The fonts are considered. The words arranged in groups that resemble sentences. Footnotes cite famous Frenchmen, even. There's Pierre Bourdieu on the bottom. An illustrative image accompanies the text. A translator is mentioned. But in much the same way that Benjamin's art historical lecture on the later works of Mondrian resembles an art historical lecture without actually being one, the content of this catalog essay fails to conform to its form. Even the person of the Slovene Benjamin plays this line between the expectation of the expectation and the actuation of an ideal type. For despite his choice of appellation, he has taken no care to resemble the historical Benjamin. I have a nice picture for you. He looks rather like a mid-level functionary in a large, nondescript governmental agency, an average man in a suit. Here, there is no mustache, no glasses, no unruly hair, none of the first Benjamin's characteristic heft. This Benjamin is, in fact, so average as to have taken averageness as his model more than the historical personage of his namesake, who is not, by all accounts, average-looking at all. This Benjamin, the false one, does not trouble the eye. And it's true. You wouldn't notice him on the street. It should now be clear that fidelity to those essential qualities of a form that would serve to make it a believable exemplar of an ideal type is not what Slovenes are after in crafting objects, persons, texts, and performances, and perhaps even when fashioning themselves. This conclusion is reached without the need to read into the works and personages given. Just reading them is sufficient. Their infidelity is both abundant and aptly in evidence right on the surface. And though foreigners, myself included, will scrape almost endlessly in the dirt like some psychotic chickens in search of the true, authentic, real roots of a given form, what is both more curious and more relevant to the current discussion is to ask what the positive content of these works and persons reveals. And if any of you guys know these people, if you want to talk about this scrabbling for truth, Laibach, like decades and decades of work, people going in to try to figure out who they are. Slovene punk band, who you may or may not know. But what of selves that are faceted by others, of a subjectivity that stretches outward, collapsing what it touches back into an apperceivable form? The collective, for example, can enjoy a cigarette. What of beings that are conduits not only of each other, but of the things with which they come into relationship? It is not only the false Benjamin who shows us this, almost as if in jest, but we see it in Maya Lutzel's commentator's transference. We see it as Maya Lutzel's commentator transfers agency first from the art object to the human. It gives an impression that lexically at least is not to be refused. And then later he collapses the generic listener, viewer into the male. And later still the singular into the plural. By the end it is not he, but we that are transformed. It's not he, but we that are forced and we that are trapped. And finally the animate into the inanimate as the subjective returns to itself. The form and the various substances that constitute a person, while mutable, are not made so by means of references to essences and insides, but always by the complexity and the imperative of its bindings beyond the singular. 2. Walter Benjamin et al. Speaks his mind. Ljubljana, 1986, 2001, 2003. There are proofs that have not yet been offered. In fact, some of the most interesting moments of the evidence supplied has thus far been ignored, though I shall try to rectify that now. I've said only that persons are complex but not deep, that they shimmer in unusual ways on the surface, and that they recruit unusual elements, philosophical and physical, to complicate these surfaces. I've spoken of averageness but not of sweat, of Maya Lutzel without pointing out that she, despite being naught but a clean head on a TV screen, is also doubled. I've barely mentioned copies, though they are of the essence. And Lacan, with his notion of the subjective void, is entirely absent. I have mentioned two-ness, doubleness as one of the quintessential concepts of Slovene life. Nor will I. Nor have I raised the problem, an immense problem, of how and under what circumstances one speaks for oneself. Before closing, I will address some of these omissions, the last of them most especially. We begin again with Benjamin, though not so long-windedly as before, and the double problem of knowing others and of speaking for oneself. We know Mondrian, the Slovene Benjamin tells us, just by looking at the paintings. We see him in them. It is not his skin that we see in their skin. This is not a moment of formal portrait, self-portraiture. We see rather something more essential and more difficult to grasp than a visage. We see painted there, on the surfaces of his paintings, his interest. His interest in the problems of space, of planes, or perhaps plans, of verticals and horizontals. We see his interest in primary colors, in gray, in black, yellow, and red. And all of this, we are told, is apperceivable in the painting itself. We do not need the artist to explain himself. We do not need the artist at all. He is, after all, and despite Benjamin's temporal claims to the contrary, dead. Yet because he is present in the thing, we can know him in ways that are both fundamental and nuanced. This sentiment should also be familiar to Western consumers of art. There is, or was, a sort of magic attributed to the artist's hand, that when he touched brush to paint and paint to canvas, something essential of himself, something we might call genius, was transferred onto the object and in daubs and smears made manifest upon it. There was another Benjamin, as some among you might recall, who once long ago spoke about this phenomenon at length. And though there is a different evidentiary logic at work in the two arguments, the resulting claims are much the same. The object, as it is read by Benjamin, is not other than Mondrian. Likewise, when we look at the copy, we know for sure that the unknown painter of the copy was not concerned with horizontals, verticals, colors. This is a quote. We know for sure that the unknown painter of the copy was not concerned with horizontals, verticals, colors, and backgrounds when making the painting. We say, just by looking at the copy, quote, that the sole sensible reason for this copy being made was in fact that copying Mondrian is nonsensical. How do we know this? Not by speaking to the artist, not by demanding that he express in words what his motivations, his interests, and his curiosities were. Indeed, we do not know who this artist is. We do not know if he is singular or, for that matter, if he is male. Yet despite the fact that there are many reasons one might copy a Mondrian, we know unequivocally that the subject of the artist's interest was, quote, the copy itself and its relation to the original. And we know this too from the surface of the painting. His interest is just as self-evident as Mondrian's, and his being is every bit is coterminous with his product. The two paintings may be all but indistinguishable, but this does not prevent the two artists present in them from appearing as discrete entities, knowable as such. The certainty that I attach to this point proceeds from Benjamin's own, for it is here at the very end of his lecturing that he exits the frame of fantasy and speaks firmly with a universalizing voice of authority. To the quote. This utterance, quote, the subject of the artist's interest was in the copy itself and its relation to the original, is one of the only in the whole of the performance, which is much longer than the excerpts I have provided you with here, in which he makes a firm statement. Gone for the space of a single breath is the equivocation, the plural self, the rhetorical questioning, and the theatrical extravagancies that characterize the rest of the work. Breathe in. And then it all comes back again. Breathe out. And for one instance more, it recedes. And he says, this means that the copy contains an idea of its ideal, as well as its own idea, the idea of a copy. Hence it follows paradoxically, although seemingly truly, that the copy can be multi-layered in its meanings and more complex than the original. Breathe out. His point having been made, this is after all the denouement of the entire endeavor. He slips back into character and subjective complexity again and continues. Can we now imagine what good old Mondrian would have to say about all of this? Note that equivocation, the plural self, rhetorical questioning, theater, are all brought back in here in one fell swoop, recentering us and him firmly back within the framework of the performance. He is speaking here ever so briefly in these, I think I can go back up, right? In these two sentences. Not as a performer who utters the words of others faithfully, such that the show might go on, nor is the man we might presume him to be when not on stage, but rather he is speaking with surety of and for himself as the ersatz Benjamin. A clarification, though hopefully not a necessary one, he is not here in this instance pretending to be Benjamin. All the trappings of theater have been thrown momentarily away. He is actually being an impersonation of Benjamin. And it is at this point, when he is most thoroughly aligned with the copy, indeed almost indistinguishable from it, that he speaks his mind, which is the mind of a copy, and voices his own opinions, which are likewise the opinions of a copy, albeit a lively and quite self-conscious one. In claiming for the copy a multi-layered complexity of meaning absent from the original, he's claiming the same for himself. If nothing else is indubitable, this one thing is. Benjamin grants the copy, himself included, a complexity that supersedes that of the original. the false betters the true. Were this the only moment at which this, at which what might be termed earnest self-representation was performed in a way unexpected to a Westerner, this Westerner before you, as well as others baffled and befuddled, I would not make so much of it, but it was not. Notice above in the text on Maya Lutzel's work, and I'll go, so here's the last page. In the text of Maya Lutzel's work, both the Slovene version and the English one have translators listed. So, Prevedala by Špela Vranec, and translation by Efride Kapala. There is information, opinion, even the lexical construction of a generic social body, but no original. In both cases, the Slovene and the English, it is the copy that speaks for and as itself. Likewise, when Maya Lutzel speaks, it is with two voices. Both are her own, but neither is fully intelligible, because one is constantly interrupting and commenting upon the other. Even if one were to insist upon untangling these texts in order to get at the truth of them, the twining of subjectivity is complex enough that a consideration of each element of the work independently of the others would render invisible the essence of the work, which abides in the confusion of sounds emanating from what appears to be a singular subject. Of course, even this is an illusion, for it is not actually Maya Lutzel who is speaking, it is her head, alone, that speaks, and even this at one degree of technological remove from her person. It is a copy of her that speaks, in her voice, twice over. Strange subjectivities abound. I could provide a tome of exemplars, some much weirder than these, some horrifying, and some much simpler, pleasant, even giggle-inducing. There are people who I thought existed, like the oft-quoted student of Slovenian art, Luther Blaset, who turned out to be almost entirely fictive. And there are others who I presume did not exist, like mythic Irina Vulle, who, despite any positive proof to the contrary, I have been consistently assured is real and lives and breathes, albeit somewhere beyond the bounds of my perceptual experience. What these plays with subjectivity hold in common are procedures, much like those detailed above, that distance the individual from his or herself by multiplying surface-level complexity while simultaneously voiding the center of any positive content. Were Slovenes just speaking among themselves and to other locals, usually culturally and linguistically integrated Croats, none of this would matter very much. I would stand before you here as little more than a documentarian entering an academic debate about how people in different cultures self-constitute and self-represent differently. The stakes are, however, much higher. As Slovenia has moved into Europe, a process for which there was significant popular support, it has become increasingly common for outsiders like myself to come and blithely demand that individuals speak for themselves. I will spare you the details of my many, many, many absurdities these attempts produced during the course of my own research. Suffice it to say that expecting Slovenes to voice their own opinions, occupy their own roles, and speak for themselves was not a highly successful research strategy. More important than my own protracted learning curve, however, is the particular sort of failure that has greeted Slovenes as they approach European cultural integration as if it were primarily a mimetic process. Three, this is short. Mimesis and Scotsman. Although many famous men, most of whom are or were Western Europeans, have written about authenticity, none have proved so useful to me in my thinking on the subject as a non-famous man, albeit still a European one, by the name of Sean Kingston, who in a short article entitled The Essential Attitude points out that contrary to popular perception, the authentic only comes into being as a conceptual category at moments of ontological doubt. Authenticity, Kingston says, is, quote, a magical effect, similar in many ways to the technology of enchantment that anthropologist Alfred Gell identified as being the key to the efficacy of art. Both play on a dissonance between the visual experience and the viewer's expectation of what or how things generally are. Authenticity only arises when there is some salient aspect of the object which is obscured from the regularities of experience that give rise to unquestioned confidence. In other words, authenticity only becomes notionally possible when something in the object or in the person is obvious in its darkness, when something lurks unseen, ungrasped, yet nevertheless irritates suspicions in the realm of easy perception. Kingston locates this black box of ontological inaccessibility in, quote, times and places beyond the immediate horizon, or in mental phenomena such as intention, belief, and agency. Curiously, these are precisely the conditions of doubt that divinatory practices would otherwise in other cultures be used to resolve. In both cases, that of attempting to establish the authenticity of something or some being, and that of divination, what is hidden by distance, whether temporal or spatial, or secreted by the substances of solid bodies, is nevertheless assumed by the seeker to be knowable. Or to quote Fox Mulder, the truth is out there. Among those who lack a sure means of establishing the veracity or speciousness of an object or a person, Western Europeans, Protestants, atheists, Marxists, to name a few, there is a marked tendency to develop intricate processes for determining its authenticity, while the most minor irritants, like a possibly fake set of breasts on the chest of a B-list movie star, are often imbued with a symbolic significance quite out of keeping with their actual import. Questions of authenticity, that is to say, itch. They promote a scrabbling into that darkness of histories unknown, distances unseen, or interior states impossible to conclusively divine. Likewise, anxiety over the inauthenticity of beings and things emerges most strongly when the darkness that secrets the itching clawing of doubt is lost. One sees, for example, a Scotsman walking down a Ljubljana street, perfect in every way, even to one such as me who has never seen a real Scotsman, or at least not one dressed up to look like one. This should be reason enough for the itchings of suspicion. Why hear this Scot? And why dress as if from a picture book and not in jeans and a tight dark blue sweater like the rest of the northern world? Such doubts, according to Kingston, are sufficient in themselves for one to question the authentic Scotsness of the Scotsman. But it was his walk, tight-hipped, efficient, identical to that of a Slovene man of his age, and the fact that he turned without hesitation, without even looking, to enter that season's hippest cafe that made me sure, except not entirely, that that was no Scot. Another example. On the train from New Haven to New York City to see a Laibach show, four men enter the rail car wearing starched, pressed, gunmetal gray shirts, hair slicked back from their foreheads, straight black pants, suspenders, shine shoes, military jackets, or jackets cut to resemble these. I poke my companion, feeling a bit stupid. This is, after all, the train to New York City on a Friday night. All types abound. Look, I say, I bet they're going to the Laibach show. And indeed, when we arrive, there they are. The difference in these two instances is clear. In the second case, imitation results in a positive attribution. These Teutonic imitators are authentic Laibach fan, while the Scotsman is a fake Scotsman. He's a Slovene dressed as a Scot. They are Americans performing fandom. The bright light of knowledge in both cases, when used to illuminate a lurking indeterminacy, collapsed doubt in one direction in one case, and in the other, in the other. More than this, one should not be surprised by the fact that the Americans were performing sincerely themselves, while the Slovene was playing, perhaps also sincerely, at being other than himself, without being quite thorough enough in his approximation to be mistaken for actually being that which he only pretended at being. Thus does the list of mimetic infidelities grow. Catalogue essay, Benjamin, art history lecture, Mondrian's, and now Scotsman. In life as in art, a commitment to representative fidelity was neatly sidestepped in favor of a complexity of surfaces of precisely the sort that troubles, in Kingston's words, unquestioned confidence. Slovenes are not failing to produce authentic representations. They are not producing them on purpose. And it is at precisely this point that the entire system breaks down. For no matter how skilled Slovenes might be at mimesis, no matter how earnestly they may laud the productive capacity of the copy, they will appear false to those who expect fidelity in the darkness as well as in the light. In a world of authentic fandom, they are not but false Scotsmen.